staff, members of the public, also those that are watching electronically. I'd like to declare the meeting open at 4:02. Ordinary council meeting for Tuesday, the 16th of February. I would like to begin by acknowledging the Wangal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of this land. I would also like to pay my respects to the elders, both past and present, and extend that respect to our First Nations people who may be present. Can I ask you also please to be, well, we won't upstand because we're, but to bow your heads for the council prayer. Lord, we humbly beseech thee to vouchsafe thy blessing on this council, direct and prosper its deliberations for the advancement of this area and the true welfare of its people. Amen. I might just also note that we have our council meetings and committees audio recorded for the purpose of assisting with the preparation of the meeting minutes and also for promoting public transparency. The recordings are subject to the provisions of the Government Information Act of 2009 and are promptly made available for public review via the council website. I note there are no apologies or leave of absence. As all councillors are present, we have two councillors that are online, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Chan, and also Councillor Del Duca, who are online. Declaration of interest by councillors. Do I have any declarations of interest?
No.
I might just declare a non-pecuniary conflict of interest and may ask the Deputy Mayor to take over the item, which is item 5/21, which is 105 to 115 Liverpool Road build. The reason being is I've noticed the applicant, who is not the owner, but for some reason has been listed as the applicant, Urbanlink, which is an architectural firm, are currently doing some architectural work for my family. So they're in the process of doing that. So I'll remove myself. I believe you still have a quorum for that item. Any other declarations of interest? Is there any declarations of political donations that need to be? There will be a recording of councillors voting on planning decisions because there's two VPA matters. And there is a planning matter. Confirmation of minutes.
I'll move that way.
So it's been moved by Councillor Fernay Cook that the minutes of the council meeting held on the 8th of December 2020 be approved and adopted. It's been seconded by Councillor Manor. Any speakers for, against, I'll put the motion. All those in favour, those against, I declare that carried unanimously. Mayoral minutes, there's two mayoral minutes on the business paper. I'm not going to read through all the minutes unless councillors would like me to, but I've got, have you got the other one there, Tommaso? The PCA one, I've only got one, unless I've misplaced it. It's in the business paper. It's okay, it's in the business paper. So the first item is an item regarding to the heritage conservation areas policy review. Just in summary, I mean, the summary's there, I'm not going to read through it all, but there is a motion that I will put for councillors to consider. The main issue is consistency with the extensions on some of the properties that are within conservation areas. And I think we only need to look at some examples, most recently in the Melvyn Hill Estate, where we've got some extensions that fit quite nicely in character with some of those homes. Some rules have applied differently to other rules. And then you've got some, I guess, extensions that while may have been assessed of not being viewed from, you know, a publicly accessible place, can be seen. And some of them look like ship containers, for example. And I think it's just sort of sending the wrong message to the community, because now when we have our planning staff trying to assess and provide some feedback on some of these applications, they're using those as examples. And I'm not sure if that's the type of example we want to be sending. So what I have asked is for the general manager to review the current heritage conservation areas provisions in the build LEP and DCP and make comparison with contemporary best practice regarding addition and alterations to dwellings with heritage conservation areas, to investigate communication initiatives, publicly available information or other online resources that can be provided to the community to promote awareness regarding appropriate additions and alterations dwellings within HCAs. Three, provide a future report to council outlining recommended revisions or initiatives for actions. Four, notify the board and district historical so and other interested groups when the review report is issued. One other important example I want to give is, for example, the conservation area at the Witchbury, Witchbury Street conservation area around Croydon. And when the Maronite Church was applying for a childcare centre, there was quite strict conditions put in place to protect the streetscape of the three homes along Witchbury Avenue. And there was a compromise that came about where the facades or the first 10 metres of the homes would be protected and there'll be an addition to the rear so it still looks like homes and their front yards. And then you go around the corner in the same conservation area and you had St. Anthony's home, which is quite a historic home, completely knocked down. And now you've got these containers that are sort of been replaced or built there and these like real modern structures within this conservation area. And my question is, how's that assessment? So you're within the same conservation area. There's probably more history of St. Anthony's home and convent there than there was with the three homes on Witchbury Avenue. Why was there a different standard applied? Was it because there was probably more objections to the Maronite Church proposal than the other one? I'm not sure. I mean, these are the questions I think need to be answered. And I'm not saying what has happened with Witchbury Avenue in protecting the homes is wrong. And what I'm suggesting is it looks quite odd now. And while I support, you know, sort of the renewal of St. Anthony's and what they're trying to do there, I'm not sure if it fits within the character. And I'd really like to see what the rest of the community around that area feel like, considering there was quite strict conditions placed on the Maronite Church. And then there's also this confusion, whereas in some instances in a conservation area, we're applying or allowing the demolition of a property. In some of the other areas, we're suggesting you can't demolish. So what are the standards? And that's what's creating, I think, some form of confusion. And that's why we need to get our standards in place to ensure that we get the best outcome in protecting the conservation areas, if that's what the goal is. Did you have a question, Councillor?
Yeah, I had a question through you, Mr. Mayor, just based on that, because that was a very interesting observation, which I agree with. I'm wondering if that was through the planning panel or the Sydney East planning panel, the St. Anthony's, and what learnings that staff have from that we could transport into to tighten up or to reflect our, you know, particularly our DCPs, because, you know, obviously DCPs are used as a guideline, and I'm wondering if, you know, how staff approached that one and whether it was overridden by the planning panel in whatever. And what take-homes do our staff have to tighten up? So in that review, perhaps we could have some reflection from staff about, you know, the learnings from the planning panels, either the regional one or the local one.
Regarding St. Anthony's?
Regarding what they look for.
I think we might just take that on note.
What do they take into account?
We'll take that on note. I might get the GM, because I was going to actually raise for a memo to be requested. I'm not going to add that in a minute, only because I don't want to feel like I'm picking on them. Yeah, but I think we need to sort of have a look at what happened there, because from my understanding, it was actually a recommendation for approval and got sign off from our heritage advisor, which I was fancy turning up to the digging of the soil, taking pictures, and then the project manager is telling you that building's getting demolished. And I'm sort of looking, saying, are you serious? Like, was that approved? And it came as quite a shock. I actually thought it was quite a, and I know it's probably lived its use by date, but in saying that, what, I mean, you only need to go out and have a look what's there now and have a look at the pictures of what the St. Anthony's convent was prior. And well, there you go. I mean, Councillor Farrell, you'd know, and I'm not sure if you've seen what's been built there now. There's a row of quite modern, boxy, single-storey, and I can understand they're trying to have a modern influence because it distinguishes from the heritage items that are close by. But it looks like quite a modern, for a residential street anyway, quite modern type structures that are quite boxy.
Just note with that, I think I wasn't really just focusing on St. Anthony's or thinking of broader, but I think some of the arguments with St. Anthony's, it was, even though it was seen as a convent, it was also an orphanage so it has had in its bones quite a checkered past.
Mm. Okay. Any other questions regarding the minute? Councillor Dixon.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, I have one serious question about Mayor's minute is, when you say I've observed that some instances there have been inconsistencies in the way in which current policy has been applied to residential dwellings. Now, I don't want to read further, when he says specifically this in relation to single or two-story additions and alterations. My point is, well, I cannot question your ability of observation, which must be lasting for more than 20 years in Burwood Council.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more anecdotal, and I think my other fellow councillor also. But the question is because a policy decision or policy matters, which has larger implications and without any attachments and details, how far do you think it is consistent with the issues of policy to bring mayors a minute, rather than had it been a good motion with those inconsistencies, details, perhaps don't you think it would have been a better option for us to look into it in a more serious manner? Yes.
I don't think it's more serious than a minute.
What I'm saying, because we don't have the details. You have your 20 years of experience, which I don't have.
Yep.
My other half of the fellow councillors, they don't have it. So I'm not questioning your intent. Please bear with me.
No, I understand.
So if there have been a detailed inconsistency, even if it being noted, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so we would have been more active participants and supporting your, this issue, and would have taken a larger picture of Burwood Council. That's my question.
That's okay. And I can understand where you're coming from, but the minute is calling for a review from the general manager. It's not calling for any other action. It's just to review some of these inconsistencies. And in saying that, it's probably, and looking at it in hindsight, it's probably simply because I've seen a lot more of it that's been happening via meetings in the mayoral office. To ask for a full-on fledged report for a motion or a minute, I think would be, it might sort of forego an independent review. So I don't want to be sort of in that process. I think the GM and the staff are aware of some of the inconsistencies. And I didn't want to mention some of the individual properties there because I didn't want to feel like I was picking on a particular design, because everyone has a different view of a design. But I would have thought, and knowing the Melvin Hill Conservation Area, there's a number of second-story additions which fit quite well within what residents expect in that conservation area, and what I deem is probably acceptable that fit within that character. There's a couple that have been recently approved and one that's been constructed, which is quite out of character with the area. And my question is, I guess, is that the right call? Can we be doing these type of assessments better? I had concerns with that type of design used, considering it could be seen from the actual street as well as from the side street. And I don't want to go into the details of the property, but that property, for example, has a second story addition which looks like a shipping container, which is quite out of character with the Federation type homes that are in that Melvin Hill estate that residents are quite proud of. So that's I guess my question. So it's asking for that review, but in any event, I can't give you any more on that question. I mean, you're free to vote for it or against it. That's fine. I mean, I don't take it personally.
The question is not voting, Mr. Mayor, because the fundamental question is we are eventually a part of the same team and we have the same intent. My only question, very humble question, is we've got such a good team, excellent, experience with that. Had it been in a broader, like if you take the scope of it, it's so widening. It's one of the oldest council in New South Wales. And I don't know how well we are.
So what did you want me to add? I'm not sure I'm following. So
my question was, instead of bringing a mayor of Minette, had it been a complete motion, at least with some details, so we would have been a better participant.
A minute is like a motion, so it's a mayor's motion.
Yeah, that's...
The report that I think you're looking for would be the next stage. So that will be after the review happens.
Well, I hope that more details would come up with that.
I think you're wanting the report before the motion.
No, all good.
What's your saying, Councillor Farrar-Cook? You want the... you're throwing out the... Yeah, the car. Yeah, that's it, yeah.
No,
Councillor Farrar-Cook.
I did not want a horse. I want a full bullock cart. that's the whole story. Anyway.
I understand that, but I think that report will be coming after we ask for a review. So it's not actually having a full report and deciding on an outcome tonight. This is the trigger, exactly. So that we'll now, if councillors support for a review, it will then come back via a full report, like a full council item, which will be much more broader. Any other questions? I'll put them in. All those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? I declare that carried unanimously. Our next item is the PCA items, and which is investigation into the role of private principal certifying authorities in ensuring building work is carried out in accordance with the Build Council approved development plans. I'm not going to read through the summary again. The recommendation is there. The recommendation is to address a number of issues, I think, that we've been seeing at some stages. And when I say we've been seeing, it's not all development applications, probably about under 5%, I would say. Would that be right, Dylan? And in most recent cases, we've had a number of examples where we've had PCAs, for example, have signed off and allowed an occupation certificate for a development to be occupied. And it's then since come to council's attention that the landscaping in that development hadn't been complied with and was non-existent. And that's quite serious. So for a PCA to be signing that off without some form of coming back to council for an amendment, I think sends sends the wrong message to the community. Most builders are doing the right thing and complying, so are landowners. And it's these instances that make our residents angry and actually make other builders and developers angry because they're getting tarnished with the same brush. And My concern is, where's the recourse for the PCA or the actual developer who's going to do the wrong thing? And I think we need to draw a line in the sand and say, look, we're not going to tolerate. And we have been doing that for some time, but we need more help from the state government and also in relation to legislation. Because if you were to have used a council certifier to certify, for example, a property which was not consistent or had been changed from the original consent, and that council certifier had signed off on that, there would be major repercussions on that certifier that was employed by council. And one of those would be a possible referral to the Independent Commission Against Corruption, which is a corruption watchdog. And yet you have a private certifier who's doing or undertaking the same job. There's no recourse other than a complaint. And most of those that have lost their licenses, for example, like the certifier that the private certifier that was involved in the project along, I think it was one railway parade, they may have their license suspended, and then they go on and use one of their friends or another certifier's license to continue working. So there's got to be a stronger deterrent and the possibility of being investigated via the corruption watchdog, as well as having the building commissioner involved now to either shut down the site and strip the PCA's license and then have a possible inquiry. Because there's no excuse for allowing a development, for example, to not comply with council's landscaping requirements and sign off on it. So that's sending the message to the community and to developers and council that it doesn't matter what you have in your LEP codes or your DCP codes, we don't need to comply with it because a private certifier will sign off on it. So how's that supposed to work in an open, transparent planning system? And that's what raises concerns. So my minute is that the general manager investigate the manner and form in which Bellwood Council currently issues development consents to identify initiatives that will promote improved development compliance during construction. So what that's also is asking for is what type of safeguards do we have in place to ensure that ongoing developments that are actually happening, that we kept in the process or the loop of following up to ensure that they are complying with the development approval. Because one of these examples was brought to us via a complaint from a number of residents. So if that complaint hadn't come through, it could have slipped through to the keeper. So what strategies do we have in place to ensure that we go out and have some form of assessment or overview on a private certifier to ensure that they're doing the right thing? Two, that the general manager investigate enforcement action available to Bellwood Council in relation to private certifiers that are authorising works not in accordance with development consent issued by Bellwood Council. So my question is, I know we have in the past issued an infringement, a hefty infringement to the developer, and we've asked for them to then rectify the plans or the actual development itself. But what action are we taking against the PCA? There should be some form of automatic complaint mechanism where we actually lodge a formal complaint to the tribunal to ensure that their license gets suspended, because they can then go to another council. And if councils continue to do this, we will weed out those certifiers that are not doing the right thing. Three, that the mayor sends a letter to the premier, the minister for planning and place, and the minister for customer service, urging the New South Wales government to take decisive action in relation to this issue and recommend legislative reviews to improve protection for customers and residents of the state, including the investigation of options to bring private certifiers under the purview of the Independent Commission Against Corruption. So if you're doing the same job as a council employee would be doing, why are you not then being treated the same via punishment or infringement type penalties that could apply. And four, that the general manager liaise with the New South Wales government, including the Office of Fair Trading, Building Commissioner, and Department of Planning, Industry and Environment, to highlight compliance and enforcement concerns and identify strategic compliance initiatives. Any questions? Councillor Fennacle?
Yes, I have just one question, but also ask if an addition to three, with the addition to three would be just to CC local government New South Wales, yes, as advocates.
I might CC local government New South Wales and the leader of the opposition. Yep. It should be a bipartisan.
Well, issue. Local government New South Wales is just a peak body. It's not political. It's Linda Scott.
So we'll add in CC the leader of the New South Wales opposition, the New South Wales Local Government Association, yep, as well as the SS ROC, which is the Southern Sydney Regional Organisation of Councils.
And my question would be, and this would also maybe another CC, would be, what you're talking about the building commissioners, what is their role? Is their role also regarding through PCAs? It's like, have they got a hit list going on bad PCAs?
I believe it's more so the building and building structures themselves to ensure that developers and PCAs are signing off on the actual building standards under the Building Code of Australia. So, for example, how waterproofing is being applied, how structures are being built. That's from what I understand. What I'm calling for, and I think we should CC the building commissioner as well, is what I'm calling for is there should be an added role to the building commissioner to allow the because the commissioner can actually go in and close the site down. And there's one that is closed down recently in Enfield because it was unsafe. One on Liverpool Road. So it's quite unsafe, and council issued a emergency order yesterday to make safe the scaffolding, because especially with the high winds. But anyway, the building commissioner apparently, from my understanding, has closed down the site. So he has the power to close sites down immediately. There's no reason why the building commissioner can't have some form of power to deal with PCAs and developers in closing down sites if they don't comply with certain standards. So if we have standards regarding heights, landscaping, setbacks, number of windows, privacy screens, those type of things, and they are changed, you know, possible green walls, frosting of balustrades, so laundry is not exposed, things like that. If those things are being signed off and we council's made policy on those issues and they're just being overturned by a PCA, what's the use of having the policy? Really, it flies in the face of what council is trying to achieve. And it flies in the face of a commitment that the former Premier, or two Premiers ago, Barry O'Farrell, gave to local governments and communities, when he said we're going to set up local planning panels to decide on development applications, but councils and communities will still have a say in the planning process via policy and the type of housing or dwellings or zonings that it wants in certain areas. So if we've got policies in place in relation to minimum landscaped areas, minimum setbacks, heights, frosted balustrades, as I mentioned, minimum balcony areas, minimum private space courtyard areas, and they're not being complied with, how's that having a say? And that's sending the wrong message to the whole industry. And, you know, we've been quite consistent in not tolerating it, but we need the help of the government to increase our powers for deterrence. Any other questions? Yeah. Councillor Manor?
Yeah. So I suppose there's two areas that the this one served by looks at. So I've just experienced myself through renovations that PC personal certifiers look at residential and then the big ticket ones, which is a big development, right? So under legislation, you've got, you know, the concrete, you've got, you know, the flooring, the structures, all the structural building stuff, which is the most important part of a certifier, right? If it collapses, everything turns into shit. But when you say policy, sorry. But if the policy, so policies that are made, right? So legislation, regulation is overcomes, policy doesn't overcome that, right? Policy is just policy, right? So what we're saying is, okay, the paperwork comes to council, right? It's the PCA that's his job, right? So off he goes. He goes and makes sure that everything's ticked off. At what stage does council, officers or anyone get involved in any of it? At what stage is that?
Well, that's what the minute's asking for.
Yeah, there's
got to be some form of review or follow-up from council.
Yeah, and then even then, right, the amount, like if there is an opportunity for council to be involved, you'll need full-time people, and it's a really big job, isn't it, really?
And it's a major burden on cost.
Yeah, that's right. It's huge.
Because in the past, you would commission a council certifier and then there would be a fee involved to pay for that certifier to do that work. So the government introduced, for competition and efficiency, private certification, which is fine in principle, should work, has become efficient, probably become quicker, it's probably become cheaper. It's created a new industry, that's fine. But you've got that, you know, 5% or less than 5% that are not doing the right thing. We're now having council to have to now pick up the cost of going out and chasing up and doing that work. And it's not fair. So it's not incumbent on council to have to do that. So maybe one of the things in the review that we look at is possibly writing to the government about, in events where something wrong has been done, it needs to revert back to a council certification, and council has to then employ a certifier, and that the cost of that then means the developer gets hit with another fee to pay and cover the cost of that, and then council certifies the project. Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Mayor, if I'm wrong, please correct me. As far as I'm aware of, the ISO standards are not mandatory according to Australian Building Code.
The what standards?
ISO standards, the International Standard Organization standards, which we call, are not mandatory by Australian Building Code.
Okay, I'm not sure. I know that builders use the Australian Building Code, but...
Yes, but it is international, what do you call ISO? All, you know, ISO...
What does that have to do with this?
Because ISO 9000 or standardization around the world is actually governed by that. Like when we write, when invariably ask you, okay, there has to be on every page number, there is a date, for example. So these are being set by a standard organization so that a document is standard, for example, when we say control document. Similarly, kind of equipments we use in building industry, kind of a wall we do that, kind of concrete we use it, kind of steel we do that. It has to be ISO certified, but that is not a mandatory in Australia. So whether it's a council certifier or whether it's a, you know, private certifier, if you are not able to have a good standards and it's a question of life and death, then perhaps...
I don't know, I'm confused. Because I know there's a building code of Australia,
yes,
that developers use.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm not sure how that goes into an ISO.
I'll put this.
But in saying that, how does that relate to this?
I'm coming to this point. The point is, there is a body called International Standard Organization, which decides all the standards of the world. Like even for the what is length, what is meter, what is kilogram.
Okay.
So that body decides as a primary body, and the rest of the national governments follow those standards. Like we have got a CSIRO here, and there's a organization.
How does that apply to a PCA doing the wrong thing?
Sorry?
For example, how does that apply to the minute? I want to stick to the minute.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. What I'm trying to say that when you are saying about certifying authority, what do the certifying authority does? They look at the standards, whether the person who is constructing a building, for example, is he following certain standards?
That's right.
And if your Australian standards are of a lower level in terms of Australian building code, which is not up to the standard of international standards, then naturally you are going to fall prey of malpractices and other issues.
That's an issue for the government, but I'm talking about PCAs that are not following the standards in our DCP. I'm not talking about IOS standards or whatever they are.
What I'm trying to say that when you're talking about they're not following this, but the serious...
I'm talking about landscaping requirements. So we've got a 30%, for example, a 25% minimum landscape requirement.
This is what I'm saying is it has the ISO standard. And the ISO standard...
That's a standard in our DCP.
This is what
Mr. Beck, can I jump in on a point of order? Because it was actually from, and I thought about it when Councillor Manor was speaking, and now given that I think it's on both sides, I will.
Councillor Del Duca, I can't hear you. I might just get him to put the volume up. Can we just get the volume up a bit? Sorry, Councillor, just one sec. Go for it, Councillor. Let's hear that.
Yeah, I just a question slash point of order. I thought about saying something when Councillor Manor was speaking, but then I didn't. But given now that we've got one from both sides from the last two questions, I thought I'd say I think the questions are generally meant to be questions to the motion that's been put forward. I think, and these are probably breaching more on comments or discussions that should be debate. And so I guess can we potentially try to get these questions.
I'm lenient. Thank you. Yep. So I'll uphold the point of order. Is there an actual question, Councillor Dixit,
this is what I'm saying is because it has a deeper implication, what I mean to say that, which you are not touching. Because when you are
what's the question? We're asking questions.
The question is the International Standard Organization, ISO standard, should be made mandatory. Because when you're writing to the Premier, when you're writing to the leader of opposition, because they are the people who are in the legislation area.
Okay, so that's the question.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to get into the IOS. If that's something ISO, we can sort of talk about that differently. I think that sort of, this is a bit different to what we're trying to achieve there. This is about non-compliances. But happy to talk about that if you need me to do something else in the future to write to.
That's fine.
Thanks for that point of order, Councillor Del Duca. And any other questions? I'll put them in. All those in favour?
Aye.
Those against, I declare that carried unanimously. Now, Councillor Crichton, you have... Oh, no, I'll come back to it. Because there's one person who wants to speak in relation to that. I think I'll just let them speak at that time. Councillor Crichton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You haven't noticed a motion now. I think we need to have a seconder before. So it's been seconded by Councillor Manor. Councillor Crichton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, councillors, staff and residents. The inclusion of Sarah Nelson in our council meeting papers is a significant occasion. It comes 227 years after Lieutenant Governor Major Francis Gross granted her 15 acres of land known as Nelson Farm, which confirmed her as Burwood's earliest free settler. It is equally fitting that the documentation authenticating Sarah Nelson's death and burial and her final place of rest is reported here to Council. With the assistance of the Anglican Church Diocese of Sydney, Liverpool City Council and Liverpool Genealogy Society, I can confirm that Sarah Nelson's death and burial is recorded in the Composite Church Register of Historic St Luke's Anglican Church, Liverpool, and that Sarah Nelson is buried within the site of Liverpool's first burial ground, known today as Apex Park. Sarah was allotted grave number 42 on 21 December 1817, following her death 3 days prior, aged 49 years. The finding of this documentation is so important to our story of Burwood. It closes out the long-held thought that Sarah's fate is unknown and it affords council with an opportunity to revisit, to further research, and to honour her remarkable life. Sarah Nelson was our earliest free settler by just 2 weeks. She was a landholder and a farmer. She was a mother with her daughters Isabella, Louisa, and Harriet, all born during her first 5 years at Nelson Park. And she was the wife of Isaac Nelson, a convict who was sentenced in Staffordshire, England, for 7 years penal servitude in Botany Bay over the theft of silver-plated goods. Sarah was a 23-year-old married woman when she arranged her own passage as a free settler aboard the Third Fleet convict women's ship, the Mary Ann, arriving into Sydney Cove in July of 1791. This earned her another title, that of convict wife, and it positioned her on the edge of two distinct but very interconnected worlds, that of being a free settler and that of being married to a convict. Further research is needed, but it is very likely that Sarah was the eighth on the list of 106 convict wives who arrived in the first 25 years of the colony. Against the odds, Sarah Nelson secured her acreage, Nelson Farm, with the terms that she would reside on this land and proceed to its improvement and cultivation. And it appears that these conditions were met, as the 1806 muster lists Sarah Nelson as having 11 acres under pasture and 4 acres fallow. I have viewed many of Sarah Nelson's records online, showing her arrival into Sydney, her land grant, the various musters, and now her death and burial. I would like council to seek the necessary permissions from New South Wales State Archives to make Sarah Nelson's state records available and for a copy to be held here in our local studies collection, and for our staff to conduct further research, allowing us to then share and honour Sarah Nelson's story with our community. I haven't been able to find any public tribute to Sarah Nelson or to the Nelson family within our LGA. It seems our early civic fathers overlooked the opportunity to remember our first free settler to Burwood. It is now time to consult with our community about honouring Sarah Nelson of Nelson Farm at an appropriate location in Croydon. I do dedicate my notice of motion to the life and memory of Sarah Nelson, 1768 to 1811. And Mr. Mayor, if I could now move, please, that the Mayor writes to the Anglican Church Diocese of Sydney, Liverpool City Council and Liverpool Genealogy Society to express Council's gratitude for their assistance in sourcing the death and burial record and final resting place of Sarah Nelson, Burwood's earliest colonial settler. 2, the Mayor consults with the community over the installation of a plaque in honour of Sarah Nelson. 3, the General Manager ensures that Sarah Nelson's story is comprehensively researched by our local studies staff and is shared with Burwood Historical Society and our community, including our secondary schools. And 4, that the General Manager ensures that Sarah Nelson's story is recognised where possible and on International Women's Day. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Crichton. Councillor Manner, did you want to add anything to this as a second?
I say congratulations to Councillor Crichton for her research and bringing this to light, especially given that that era mainly was dominated by men. So, and women, well, to a certain degree, it's good for her.
Perception was it was dominated by men.
Sorry?
Perception was it was dominated by men, but yeah, I think history is showing us otherwise.
Anyhow, well done.
Councillor Fernow-Cook, you wanted to add something?
I just wanted to support the motion. The reality is she probably owned it on behalf of her husband. That's what, because he as a convict couldn't own property. But that doesn't mean in your motion that her journey, particularly out there, her decision to accompany him when so many people didn't, being by herself, raising children in a desolate area, trying to manage land, that is you just can't take it away from the person, and she is that very first settler, colonial settler, where we have to be very aware of how we frame this as well in our conversations, because there obviously the land had other people on it prior to Sarah Nielsen. The only other thing is just with the president of the Historical Society rang me, and she was very excited about this. They're very excited. They too have found that Dunlop's assessment is in error. Rather than just share, they actually do have information on her already. So, you know, I think it will be a bit of a two-way thing. They did suggest the Malvern Hill where Emile Hall is, because that is the actual spot where she owned the land. And that would be just, you know, a great spot. Does it have it? Reed's Reserve, I think.
Reed Reserve.
Yeah. I'm sure the Geographical Names Board would love to change it, because that's what they're after, Indigenous names and recognition of women, because it's mainly men's names that are put up, and it just continues. It just continues, like 2%.
Yeah, and it'll be a great story.
And there's a lot of narrative around it too, which just will make it really almost fit in with that Your Mayoral Minute as well. So I certainly endorse that. I only have one question, which is a follow-on question about, you know, International Women's Day, because as one of the few women on council, I haven't heard anything about Burwood Council's celebrations of International Women's Day.
I don't think we've planned it yet. Only because I
never hear about it.
Well, so the GM's just advice. No, I think you have in the past. You've been at a few of the events. No? Really? No, I think so. I'm going to pull out some pictures. I'm sure I've had you there. I'm not going to get cheeky. In saying that, though, no, I'll check. But I believe the last couple of years we might not have had a celebration, only because the last year especially because of COVID, but I'm not sure this year, but it'll be great to actually celebrate Sarah Nielsen and make a story of it this International Women's Day in our celebrations in Burwood anyway. Councillor Del Duca, did you have a question?
No, I wanted to speak to the motion if I could.
Yeah,
speak in favour. Yep, sure. I'd like to speak in favour of this motion from Councillor Crichton. I think it's great. We are very blessed to represent an area which has such an amazing and rich history. And I think it's really, one thing that gets lost on many people actually is how much and how deep our history is. So I think any steps like this that we can do to recognise, you know, people that have been an important part of the story of Burwood, to have plaques in their honour, and also, you know, to get that information out there. I think we've spoken about it in other things as well around, like, you know, the St. Luke's Walk and other things. And I think anything that we can do, that is making sure the information about, where Burwood has come from, in the colonial sense, and also obviously, as Councillor Ferner Cook mentioned, beyond that as well, from previous settlers that we are, recognising and getting that information out there so that future generations have a record of, you know, just the great history of Burwood. So very, very happy to support this motion. I think it's a good one.
Okay, excellent. Any speakers against? Yeah. There being no other speakers against your quick writer reply.
Thank you. Just quickly, in closing, I just wish to pay tribute to the late Eric Dunlop, the author of Harvest of the Years, The Story of Burwood, published by this council for its centenary in 1974. I do marvel at his expertise in writing this important book almost 50 years ago without the benefits of today's technologies, and I hope he would be pleased in the knowledge that Sarah's fate is known. I have raised with our general manager the possibility possibility of digitising this work so that a searchable copy could be included on Council's website and is available to everyone who has an interest in our rich history of Burwood. And finally, I do acknowledge also the role of Liverpool Regional Museum, Liverpool City Council and Liverpool Genealogy Society. Given the importance of Liverpool's first burial ground to the early days of the colony and the age of the church register, St Luke's Anglican Church immediately escalated my inquiry to Dr Louise Trott, Sydney Diocesan Archivist of the Anglican Church Diocese of Sydney, who offered me every assistance. I can't thank them all enough for their skill and interest in honouring Sarah Nelson's story, and they were so happy to be part of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Crichton. I'll put the motion. All those in favour? Those against, I declare that carried unanimously. We're going to move on to item 4/21, which is the draft voluntary planning agreement for 15 to 19 Clarence Street, Burwood. Could I just add that I have been a bit lenient with the agenda today. And I thank Councillor Dolduca for picking me up, but I was just being a bit, just a bit more relaxed considering I think it's the first meeting back. But in saying that, we're at the next meeting, and we're supposed to sort of address it at this meeting, is we're going to have the speakers on all items addressed after the open forum commences. So procedurally, rather than speak before the item, all applicants or residents or objectors or people speaking in favour will be speaking before the whole meeting on all the different items. And the general manager has spoken that apparently that's the proper order of doing things. It's the same order that's applied to council's planning committee meetings as well as the BOPP meeting. Apparently that's the proper governance process to follow. If anyone has a question about that, you can take that up with the GM. It's in light of ensuring that, and I believe governance has raised this, is that correct? But apparently it's, well, my understanding from what the explanation was to me was that's actually the proper way of doing the order. I know other councils do it that way as well. It's to ensure that everyone speaks. It then allows councillors to ask questions of the speakers as well, and then makes it a bit more interactive. And then at the same time, it then means when we're actually debating or speaking on the issue, it's not speakers haven't spoken immediately before, so there's no feeling of influence on a decision. Okay, it's a bit of a governance issue, I think. So the issue was raised by governance. And to ensure everyone has their say, it's sort of at the beginning of the meeting, like they do in the Burwood Planning Committee meetings, and then council is in a state of making decisions on the items at that time. I haven't applied it at this meeting because I thought it would be a bit different to just sort of bring this on the councillors. So I've kept it the way it was, but just know going forward, that will be the process. If there is an issue, feel free to take that up with the GM and our governance officers. Because technically in our agenda, there's no place for speakers to speak. We've taken it as norm that they speak before the item, but there's actually, it's not a proper process. We're not following proper governance to be applying that because there's no place to speak before the item. They're supposed to be speaking at open forum, but we don't want to take open forum away for people that just want to come and speak at any issue. So there's going to be an addition there, which you can see is addressed by the public on agenda item. So we're on item 4/21. Which is the draft VPA for 15 to 19 Clarence Street. There's a David Woghorn who has registered to speak in favour of the VPA. Mr. Woghorn, are you there? Mr. Woghorn, you're there?
Mr. Mayor, David Waghorn here from Planning Ingenuity.
Yeah. You've got 3 minutes to speak, and then if there's questions, I'll have the councillors put the questions to you through the chair.
Mr. Mayor, no need to, and I don't seek to influence the council. I'm just simply here to answer any questions in relation to this matter, if in case you had any.
Okay, thank you. So you're reserving your right to speak at this stage?
No need to speak, Mr. Mayor, unless there are any questions of me.
Okay. Any Questions, councillors?
Yes, through you, Mr. Councillor Mayor. Just to the general managers, just in regards to what is it, it only seeks a 0.6. So I know it's a VPA, but it's related to a development. What is it? It asks to two extra levels. Is that outside then the zoning requirements? The height of the zone. My concern is the follow-on impact.
I might just pass that on to Dylan Porter, through the general manager.
Through you there, Mr. Miller. Look, it is additional two levels of floor space, and it's consistent with our bonus floor space provisions policy, which acknowledges that some sites within the town centre can accommodate additional developments and wouldn't otherwise be harmful to the, I guess, form, nature and height of other buildings within the locality. So it allows us to assess some additional floor space that might be outside of our normal provisions in the NEP.
Can I just make a point? We're not deciding on the planning, so we need to just be careful. All we're deciding on, the planning goes to the planning panel. So all we're deciding on is the voluntary planning agreement that would accompany that approval, if it was to be approved. This doesn't guarantee it will be approved. It has to meet the planning guidelines. So we just, and I'm not trying to shut councillors down. I just want to try to make sure that we keep a straight line between, because our policy allows a 10% bonus and it's supposed to be independent of the planning assessment. And that's why we have the council votes on the actual VPA, which is the monetary arm. And then the assessment is assessed by an independent planning body on behalf of the council. They then make a recommendation, as would the council staff, via a normal report, which then gets reported to the planning panel to decide on. So I just want to ensure that what we're voting on is whether council will enter into an agreement for a monetary contribution. So that's next question, yeah. Councillor Fennell-Cook.
Yeah, yes. That's exactly right, and I understand that process. But what I've read from papers where the VPA is mentioned in the Burning Planning Panel or the Sydney Eastern Region decisions. Now, if we're saying that it's cut, then it should. So my question is, why do we mention the VPA in that separate that separate decision making on the planning? That's my question. Why is that?
Good point. I know it has to be mentioned via a condition of consent, because if we don't add it as a condition of consent, you can't then enforce it, I believe. Is that right, Dylan? But I think what the councillor is referring to is there's actually a section in the actual report, because I noticed that myself. Is there a reason for that? Is that something you can take on notice and
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, look, that's something I'd like to take on notice and research specifically. I think it wouldn't be inappropriate to report that there is a VPA in hand in relation to the application. I would have to confirm and look at whether we provide any details as to the monetary value of the VPA and the contributions being provided. And I think that's probably where we would want to keep that information separate from any decision making or assessment that the BLPP would make.
Okay, I'm getting some feedback from is Mr. Waghorn. I think you need to go on mute. Okay, just in case. Any other? Does that answer your question, Councillor Manor?
Yes. So another question is this monetary contribution to council, which is going to be used for community benefit facilities and that. So if
just speak up, Councillor.
Sorry. If it's lost here, if we don't have an opportunity,
it doesn't mean it stops the planning process. No,
that's right. So, in other words, we don't get another crack at it at a later stage. Is that right?
No, I don't believe so. No.
Okay.
Am I right, Dylan? Did you want to add something?
No, through you, mate. Councillor Mann, you're absolutely correct. I mean, this is a specific contribution in relation to planning benefits associated with the bonus floor space provisions. There still is a separate contribution made through Section 12 contributions, which is 4% of the total capital value of the project. That is still part of the original approval. This is really just dealing specifically with the additional bonus floor space provisions related to the additional two floors. So we still receive a financial contribution to public benefit associated with this development. We just wouldn't be receiving this particular DPA amount.
And I think there has been a precedence where I believe one of the VPAs was knocked over by council and it still was approved via the planning panel. So technically what happened is there was a, because council decided not to attach a VPA to the conditions of consent, and I think one of those was flower power, because council was so against the application, it still proceeded. It just meant council then didn't receive the contribution. And in hindsight, we probably should have just approved the VPA as an insurance policy that in the event the planning panel, and it was still recommended, I believe, for refusal because we put a submission in, that the council then, in the event as an insurance policy, if the panel then approves it, at least council has some form of bonus contribution. Any other questions? Councillor?
Just around the public facilities, the definition of that, is that money just to remain here right in Central Board or could it go?
Now we have a public contributions bonus plan, but I think, Dylan, did you want to add to that? It goes into a pool.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, look, we do have a broader power to spend the contributions received through public benefits. We're able to spend them on public facilities through the LGA. That would be open space, physical community facilities, or other, I guess, public improvements to facilities as well. So we do have a broader ability to draw those into other projects, rather than our Section 12 contributions, which are linked to specific forms of infrastructure, which are identified and costed in the LEP.
Good. Any other questions? Do I have a mover? Moved by Councillor Manor, seconder. By Councillor Chan. Any speakers for? Speakers against? Put the motion, all those in favour? Those against? Was that unanimous, just for the record? So that was unanimous. Next item is item 5/21, which is the draft voluntary planning agreement for 105 to 115 Liverpool Road Build. I'm just going to remove myself from the chair. And Councillor Chan, did you want to...
Yep, I'm listening.
Take over the chair as the Deputy Mayor?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. So I'll get logged back.
Sorry, I can't see where the mayor's gone or not. So would someone...
The mayor has left the chambers, councillor, so you're now the chair.
All right, so item 5/21. Draft voluntary planning agreement for 105 to 115 Liverpool Road, Burwood. Do you have any speakers on this one, or do I have to move someone to move the motion and then someone second it before we can start the discussion on this one? Any speakers for public speakers for this particular item? If there's none, would Councillor Manor move this motion for discussion? And Councillor Del Duca, second that. Would that be all right? So is anyone have any questions? I would assume that the two items are very similar, 4 and 5. So I guess everybody understand the ramifications. If we do not support this one, that we could be losing out on the contribution that would improve the amenities of our council residents. And then the development application is a separate matter, which will be dealt with in due course.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Chair, thank you for the influence on that. I've got a question through you, just in regards to, just a bit, it's only 4%, but I'm just a bit concerned through you, Mr. Deputy Chair, with regard to the location of the single-storey residential homes behind this. I know it's a planning question, but I've seen it, the VPA influence a planning decision because it's in the papers, and I've seen it again and again. So through you to perhaps planning staff, is the additional, I assume the top floor was set back to provide some buffer to the 2A residential behind. Is that now eliminated? I know that's a planning question, but it
well, is. I guess dealing would be.
No, I asked to the general manager.
Just dealing with the general manager.
Through you, Mr. Deputy Chair, just to clarify, Councillor Fanno-Cook, you're talking about the setback for the additional top floor yeah. that we've shown in there. That is designed to be set sort of inboard from the front face of the building as you see it there. So there is something in the order of two, possibly 3 metres setback from that sort of silver section of building from the front wall of the main apartment building. So it's the additional top floor is set within the footprint of the building, if I've explained that clearly.
Through you, Deputy Chair. I just thought it says the red cloud is the additional development, which tends to say that there is no setbacks now. Anyway, that's a
planning. There's a development, yeah, planning.
Yes, thank you. I'll just reserve that. That I think that's a problem from the planning point of view.
Any other questions? Because I can't see people that well from where I am. So if there's any more questions, can someone just maybe raise their hand or something so I can see who got questions? If there's no other questions. I would like to put this to a vote.
I'll move as per recommendation. Oh, we had a discussion before, wasn't it? Is that the discussion?
Have you got a seconder for that?
I'll second it.
Oh, thank you. So we can vote on it. So whoever is going forward, put up the hand. I got, is that Dr. Fanno-Cook? Have you put up your hand or you are? Because I can't see.
Hey, Councillor, well. It's a unanimous decision.
Oh, unanimous. Okay, excellent. Thank you. So item 521, we'll got a unanimous decision.
Councillor, I will pause. I think we'll let the mayor come back.
Yeah, come back in. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, councillors. We'll pick up again on the meeting agenda, and the next item is 6/21, which is the amendment to the build LEP plan to control dual occupancy subdivisions in R2 low density residentials zone, which is on page 56. Do I have any questions? So from what I could see, even though after we had representations made to the minister and he was going to look into it, I don't believe there's been any change that's been applied. So the advice, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dylan, is that if we don't have this amendment in place, then we won't be able to have a guideline. So having no guidelines could actually be worse. Did you want to add something?
No, through you, Mr. Mayor. No, you're absolutely right. At the moment, the LEP is either silent or not sufficiently clear on what we would accept in terms of subdivision of dual occupancy. So by not making any provisions, we are inconsistent with the SEP, and it's likely we'll be asked to accept development that's below the standard we would normally accept through this amendment. So it's probably not an ideal situation, and I know that there was quite extensive back and forth with the Minister's Office on this particular matter, but it's I think something that state government is seeking to enforce across all councils rather than anything specific to Burwood, and we're trying to, I think, find a reasonable middle ground for us and something that we are prepared to accept. I think the only benefit that is in there that it does specifically relate to subdivision of dual occupancies that are side by side rather than a subdivision of dual occupancies which are front and rear. So I think that is at least a better control in there for us. And then having the additional benefit around having the minimum lot size and minimum frontage, again, that allows us at least to have some controls in place. Mm.
And there's not many blocks that have a 24-metre frontage in Burwood, I think. So 12-metre for a dual lock is, if you actually look at some streets, their land subdivision actually 12-metre wide blocks. So it's quite a tough hurdle. My only concern is the only way you would find those type of blocks are the larger old heritage homes. And does this SEP apply in heritage or heritage conservation areas?
Again, the specific provisions in there which would discount heritage conservation areas and heritage items are excluded from assessment through CDC within the SEP. Okay. So again, we're protected there as well. Yep.
All right, good. Any other questions? There's a motion. It's been moved by Councillor Fernando.
Mr. Mayor.
You had a question, did you, Councillor?
It's not a question. I think it seems to be a correction.
Okay.
If you go.
I might just put the motion first, and then I'll get you to speak at that motion if it's not a question.
Okay. It's a correction, I would say.
That. Yeah. So yeah. It's been moved by Councillor Fernando. I'll get you to second it. And then now, Councillor Fernando, did you wish to speak? Councillor Dixit, as the seconder, you can now talk about the correction.
I mean,
what page are we on?
It's on page number 56.
56?
You know, the act, this, you mentioned that state environmental planning policy exempt and complying development codes. I think it is 2008. It is not 2009. I mean, I tried to verify it, if you can correct me, but.
What part of?
It's in the background, the very first sentence, the second sentence. It's in the background. A timeline of matter is provided below.
2018, it says, on the 27th of November, 2018. Is that what you're looking at? Or?
No, in the first paragraph, yes. If you look at the first paragraph in 2018, it has stated the name of the...
Oh, that's the State Environmental Planning Policy.
SEPP. That's complying code is 2008.
Oh, it's in 2008, you're saying.
Yes.
Well, we could check that.
Yeah, it's 2000.
Just for... the record on the minutes. Before the minutes get issued, we'll check that. Sometimes it gets released in 2008, it gets gazetted in 2009, so I'm not sure.
It was done in 2008, but I think some circular instruction was in February 2019.
Okay, I'm not sure.
Complying code is known as 2008.
Yeah, okay, we'll check that. Any other speakers? Any speakers against? Put the motion. All those in favour? Those against, I declare that was carried unanimously. So that was all councillors unanimously. The next item, which is a planning proposal heritage listing of 17 Ethel Street, Burwood, which is recommending to proceed. Moved by Councillor Fernando Cook, seconded by Councillor Manor. Speakers for, against, speakers against. Put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, I declare that carried unanimously.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor.
Yep, 8/21. You've got a question?
I'm against that voting.
Oh, sorry.
Please.
So the planning proposal for Ethel Street, it was moved by Councillor Fernando Cook, seconded by Councillor Manor. All those in favour, that was Councillor Fernando Cook, Manor, Chan, Crichton, myself. Those against? Councillor Del Duca. I didn't see whether you're voting for or against. Were you voting for?
Four.
Sorry, so Councillor Del Duca was for and against was Councillor Dixit. So item 7/21, No, we've done that one. 8/21, which is page 84, Enfield revitalisation. We moved a bit quick on this, and I'll tell you why. It's because we had to get a grant application in. So if you need any further information, feel free to speak to myself or the general manager or I believe Brooks' team's handling this project. Councillor Crichton, do you want to move it and then ask a question? Because we need to move it. So it's been moved by Councillor Crichton, seconded by Councillor Fernow Cook. Councillor Crichton, you had a question?
Not really a question. I just would like to raise an opportunity, perhaps. I'm really so in favour of seeing some redevelopment and some enhancements up at Enfield Village, but I really think for it to be anchored down as a village, we're missing a really big opportunity through the greening of the corner. And you may not be aware, but Arthur Yates, so the founder of Yates Seeds and Gardening Guide, well known to many Australians, he's actually buried just 300 metres down the road at St Thomas's. And we've also got still a really close connection with the Tompkins family, who was awarded the board's first art prize, so Andrew Tompkins, but his family has been really involved in the early nurseries of Enfield. So I really think we have these valuable connections that we've just got to realise, and we could easily do this through the greening of the corner with a nod back to the past. I don't want to live in the past. You may think that I do, but I love the present and the future. But I just think that these are really valuable and interesting points that could be on show there through our revitalisation, much needed revitalisation of Enfield Shopping Village. And another comment, just with the Byers Street car park, I've had a look at some of the comments online through our social media posts, and a lot of, and I think they're local residents, they're complaining that there's a lack of parking. I don't actually find that. I think that there's ample parking in the Byers Street car park. I'm just wondering if our directional signage is lacking, and perhaps they don't realise all the spots that are around the back, and they need to just be encouraged to go that way. But the times I have visited there also, there seem to be a lot of cars parked there for many hours. And I don't know if they're from the developments and they just haven't put their car away. But I think that we could really look at turning over those spaces more readily, and that would be great. So thank you. So if you could look at Mr. Yates, that would be great for that
point
spot. Thank
taken, you. Taken, Councillor. Councillor Fennell.
Yes, I just have through a few questions. I think it's a great initiative. And I've also looked at the comments. I tend to agree it may be not a village because it's got two large roads down. Probably that Tangara Enfield shopping precinct is more like the small little village with the post shop and the pizza place, etc. But the take-homes that I have, and through you as questions, are issues raised were about the cleaning of the area. Issues were also raised about the turnover of parking and the lack thereof. I'm concerned that while it's greening and there's some fundamental structural flaws in the ability of this area to take off, and that is the clearways and the parking. That is a deep structural flaw that will impede the success of that shopping precinct. So I would ask if we could really look seriously about how we make those improvements. There's not a lot of foot traffic there. That people will come in cars. So where do they go? It's not really well serviced by public transport. There's a few buses, but that people are not going on those buses to go shopping in that precinct. So there's some connectivity issues around the parking and where people are that I think we have to look at. The other one is I would ask if, as part of this, we could also liaise with Strathfield Council so it doesn't look weird, because it is particularly that intersection of the Hume Highway and Coronation Parade, or the boulevard, is an entrance gateway sort of thing, as developers love to say. But it can't be too different. It has to have some unity about it. So they would be my my question through you about the compliance and the thing, and but I'm happy to support.
Any other speakers against? Put the motion, all those, you're right to reply, Councillor. I'll put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, I declare that carried unanimously. Small Business Month tribute, page 129, 9/21. That's a report coming back regarding a notice of motion. It's been moved by Councillor Crichton, seconded by Councillor Manor. Any speakers for? Speakers against? Put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, I declare that carried unanimously. Budget review for the quarter ending 31st of December, item 10/21. Been moved by Councillor Manor, seconded by Councillor Chan. Seconded by Councillor Ferno Cook. Did you want to second it and then you could speak and have a question? Councillor Manor, do you wish to speak? Councillor Ferno Cook?
Just two questions. One on page 136. Regarding the busy recycling legal challenge, and that may be in a confidential item, but is that going to be an ongoing cost, and how are we funding it? And also another question, I'll just double them up and then you can put them where appropriate. It concerns me in part B, the legal expenses, 143, that we've had to put out these fines for non-compliance. I think we've got 8 of them for non-compliance.
Page is this on?
That's on page 143.
143.
Yeah, the list of our legal expenses, because it costs time and money for us.
No, that's right. That's part of the budget review. Yep, yeah, go on.
The question is, you know, how are these breaches found, and how can we, look at, are the fines inadequate? That's why they keep doing it. Is there some sort of mechanism that stops residents, time and money out through us hunting non-compliances down?
Okay, might take that on notice for the... Did Jim want to respond?
Oh, no, I believe just on the first question, Councillor, is the busy matter was confidential, it's still ongoing, but I believe we've got a hearing set for May. Hopefully that will be the end either way. In relation to the other matter about compliance, unfortunately it's an ongoing issue. Either through complaints or proactive inspections that compliance and community safety teams conduct, it is they discovered non-compliances, and sometimes obviously the effort and the resources and the investment that we put in does not, in the end, sort of equate to a win or costs being rewarded to council. But we still feel that it's important. I think connecting back to the mirror minute about PCA is usually that it's probably the critical point that we need to try to address so that those non-compliances don't actually occur in the first place.
So like, 12 Coronation Parade here, which has got Enfield, Suka Constructions, Proprietor, DA Bridge, it's cost us $875. So there's a DA. Why is the fine only $500? Aren't they minimum $3,000 for breaches? Clients, can we just take that on notice? It just doesn't make sense. Usually the fines are minimum $3,000 or $6,000. Dylan, did you want to?
Through you.
Or is this another fine?
There could be two elements to that. If there's been a challenge through the courts and council has been successful, we are entitled to reclaim a proportion of our legal costs back from the other party.
Okay.
So that's a separate award given by the courts to cover our legal costs. There would still be a fine on top of that as well.
Okay.
So for quite a number of these matters, they are Land and Environment Court matters. So that's an appeal typically by the applicant against council's decision to refuse an application, which is something we need to manage. But a lot of these smaller items are often, I guess, legal advice in terms of how we might approach a particular matter, rather than any court costs in terms of taking an appellant to court or anything like that at all.
Okay, point taken. Any other questions? I'll put the motion, all those in favour. Oh, sorry, Councillor Dix, did you have a question?
Yes. First, you know, if through you, Mr. Mayor, it's on page number 134. Yes. At the bottom of the table, it says these material variations greater than $20,000 are detailed in the following sections. I'm referring the question to this. That can we have the details of these? That how many list of items are not considered, which are considered to be less than $20,000, these material variation, and which are not cross-referenced here. So if anybody can give me that update, or it can enlighten me in this regard.
All right, so just a clarification. So from the bottom of the 134 on, it's basically that is the breakdown of those variations in income and expenditure. We just feel from a reporting point of view, typically 20,000 for a council our size is a threshold above which we report to council. Anything below that, it's kind of the day-to-day operational breakdown of transactions, if you like. But what I think those two lines you've just read out refer to is actually those sections immediately below there. So from total income from continuing operations, then you will see all the references all right. that the CFO makes to any variation from the original budget we had.
All right. My second question through you, Mr. Mayor, is with regard to that Part B of the legal expenses. You know, there is... it's page number 143.
143, yes.
Yes. There is a big freeze for a Supreme Court in, I think, something... 13 Appian Way, Burwood.
Yes.
Yes. It's
that's the stormwater drainage issue. Yes,
that's a big legal fees. So any update on this to us? We did get a, I think...
I might get the general manager to give you an update after the meeting.
All right.
Is it
possible to get a...
that's in the courts. So we might get you to speak to him after the meeting. He'll give you an update.
All right.
It's better we don't have it in the public forum.
Okay, that'll be fine.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll put the motion. All those in favour? Those against, I declare that carried unanimously. So, Councillor, just after the meeting, speak to the GM. I think you'll organise. It's just for the... I think you understand.
Okay.
For legal issues. 11/21 investment report as at the 30th of November. 145. It's been moved by Councillor Chan, seconded by Councillor Manor. Speakers for, against. Put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, declare that carried unanimously. Item 12/21 investment report as at 31st of December. Again, it's been moved by Councillor Chan, seconded by Councillor Manor. Speakers for, against. Questions? Put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, declare that carried unanimously. Item 13/21, which is disclosure of interest returns for 19/20, which are publicly available here, I believe. It's been moved by Councillor Crichton, seconded by Councillor Chan. Put the motion, all those in favour. Those against, I declare that carried also unanimously. And item 14/21, there's a proposed change to the June meeting date. Been moved by Councillor Fernan Cook, seconded by Councillor Dixit. Speakers for and against, put the motion, all those in favour, those against, declare that carried unanimously. There's three information items there, which is item 3/21, which is the register tributes to residents. Item IN 421, which is the mayoral discretionary grants, small donations made for the period ending 31st of December. And item IN/21, which is answers to questions on notice. Questions on notice for this meeting? Do we have questions on notice? You haven't? Do you want to email them through to the GM? I just need a refresher on how we're running this.
No, we can't do that. But because it's in one of those emergency ones, residents contact me regarding activity around flower power and the heritage cottage. and they're concerned.
Do you want to email the GM the questions? Yeah. And then also ask that they be added for next meeting, because then you'll get the answer formally on the next meeting agenda item. There being no other questions on notice, I will declare the meeting closed at 5:31 p.m. Thanks for your attendance.
Thank you.
And thanks to the staff. I don't believe there is dinner.
Thank you.
We're not having dinner.
See how we hopefully continue with this. Yeah, if we continue with the